one of the ways in which the CBMs build confidence and demonstrate compliance is their documentation of national oversight arrangements for dual-use research of concern and of national biodefense research and development. The rapid pace of advances in the life sciences mean they must continually be evaluated and assessed to ensure appropriate oversight is in place. One area of the life sciences that has gained a great deal of attention recently is gain of function research, which makes certain viruses more transmissible or more deadly. We're going to hear more about the particulars of this research in a minute, but I'll just spend a couple of minutes giving you a little context to these presentations. 3 years ago, two separate research teams revealed that they had made a version of the H5N1 avian influenza strain that previously had only spread between birds, but could now spread between mammals, in this case, ferrets. Many scientists worried that if the potential new lab strain were accidentally or deliberately released, it could result in a deadly pandemic. The New York Times ran with the unambiguous storyline, an engineered doomsday. Proponents argued that such studies will help public health researchers detect an impending flu pandemic and prepare vaccines. After much discussion, a decision to publish the papers, a one-year voluntary moratorium by researchers on new gain-of-function flu studies, and new U.S. rules, the work resumed last year. But as new papers on human-made H5N1 and other dangerous flu strains have come out in recent months, concerns have been rekindled. And this is also in part because of a series of lab accidents at the U.S. CDC that raise questions about safety at U.S. high containment labs. A group calling itself the Cambridge Working Group issued a statement in July saying that studies with potential pandemic pathogens should be curtailed until the risks and benefits could be evaluated. The statement, which was read out to the MX in August, garnered hundreds of signatures. Those lobbying efforts paid off. A few weeks back, on October 17th, the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy and the Department of Health and Human Services announced that the U.S. government was launching a deliberative process to assess the potential risks and benefits associated with gain-of-function studies. During this one-year deliberation, spearheaded by the National Science Advisory Board on Biosecurity and the National Academies of Sciences, the U.S. government has instituted a pause on funding for any new studies that include certain gain-of-function experiments involving influenza, SARS, and MERS. Gain-of-function has also got a great deal of political attention in Europe. Both the European Society for Virology and the Foundation for Vaccine Research have written to the President of the EU Commission with opposing views of the science, the European Society for Virology arguing for attention to the potential benefits of this kind of research, the Foundation for Vaccine Research challenging the arguments in favor. The letters have sparked a series of debates in Europe on gain of function. In one of these debates at the European Center for Disease Control in Stockholm, over 100 field epidemiologists, microbiologists, and public health specialists voted to pause gain-of-function research in the EU until clearer policies are in place for researchers. Now, I'm delighted to say that two of the scientists who have been instrumental in the political processes, both in the United States and Europe, are here with us today. Mark Lipsitch is professor of epidemiology and director of the Center for Communicable Disease Dynamics at Harvard University. Mark was one of the founders of the Cambridge Working Group and an absolute key member in successfully lobbying the U.S. government to introduce the gain-of-function moratorium. He is currently heavily involved in the U.S. deliberative process on gain-of-function and has recently presented to the first NSABB meeting on the issue and will be presenting to the upcoming National Academy of Science meeting on gain-of-function in a couple of weeks' time. All of this while being on sabbatical this year. So thank you, Mark, for finding time in your busy schedule to be with us. An equally busy man is Simon Wayne Hobson. Simon is professor and head of molecular retrovirology unit at the Pasteur Institute in Paris. Simon was one of the pioneers of AIDS research and was the first to publish the genetic map of the HIV virus. His group went on to show that it evolved from a chimpanzee virus and has continued giving us insight into the genetic variation and evolution of HIV for the past 25 years. As many of you will be aware, today is World AIDS Day, so I'm particularly grateful to Simon for agreeing to be here with us to tell us about gain of function, an area of virology that is increasingly occupying more and more of his time. Simon is chair of the Foundation for Vaccine Research and spearheaded the gain of function letter to Barroso. He was instrumental in organizing the first open meeting at the Royal Society back in 2012 and has substantially contributed to the string of meetings taking place in the EU on gain of function since that time. Alongside Mark, Simon has also been one of the leading voices shaping the debate and policy development in the United States. This is, of course, not Simon's first time at the Biological Weapons Convention. As many of you will remember, he was a guest at the MX in 2013 and gave a terrific presentation. Then, Simon, a very warm welcome back. We look forward to hearing what you have to say today.
Right. I would like to start off, if I may, I won't be too long, to just remind you where we come from. We've been spending more than 130 years beating the daylights out of microbes. The first gentleman is Pasteur, and he needs no introduction. There are two criteria for being on this slide. You've either made a vaccine or you've discovered a microbe. My apologies to the ladies because there's an obvious gender bias, but as it's a historical slide, please forgive me. We've been beating up viruses and microbes, and now we're having to contemplate going the other way. I will maintain this represents a hiatus in our approach to microbiology, and I will say there's nothing good to be gained out of the virology. Just to give you a little inkling as to what we're really doing, or what is really being done. Influenza virus, these are the sorts of images you'll see in documentaries, magazines, and they're lovely synthetic images, the one on the top here, or these are actually electron micrographs. The important point is here on the left. There are two proteins at the surface of an influenza virus. One is called hemagglutinin, one is called the neuraminidase. These are the ones that are highly antigenic. When we make a vaccine, we fix on these two. And they're called H and N. Now, we are very anthropocentric. We see ourselves as the center of the world. But in terms of influenza, we're anything but the center of the world. The reservoir for influenza viruses are ducks, ducks and shorebirds, as you can see. And in yellow, these are all genetically confirmed viruses that you can find in ducks. And in orange, shorebirds. You'll see there are 127 combinations. That's a pretty hostile world. Reassure yourself. When it comes to us, we have only been infected by three in any serious way. And these are shown on the top left. They're called H1N1, H2N2, H3N2. These are the ones that cause pandemics. These are the ones that bother us. They scare us crazy. But this is the data in 100 years. Three viruses in 100 years. I'm taking the Spanish flu as my deadline because that's the only really obvious starting point. Three viruses. Now, all these avian viruses, they do visit us from time to time. And in red, you'll see combinations of avian viruses that can spill over and cause respiratory infections in humans. In the red, they will cause a respiratory infection of the lower part of the lung, whereas the viruses that we are very afraid of infect this part. And if I was infected by, say, H5N1, I would cough, but Mark would not get infected. The question is, as these are viruses that mutate, will one day a virus, say, produced in me, allow it to infect Mark by the aerosol route? And of course, this was the question. We have these viruses occurring Egypt, Indonesia, Vietnam, China, and other countries, of course. That's just a handful. And the question, the scientific question was, what mutations, are they many, are they few, would a virus need to be able to transmit between Mark, if I cough now, and Mark would get infected? So the scientist dreams up the experiment. And this is precisely what is a gain-of-function experiment. It means to deliberately, by any means possible, this is mean genetic engineering, means forced evolution experiments, to take an influenza virus that, if it infected me, would not infect Mark, and turn it into a virus that would infect Mark. Of course, in the lab, we do not use humans. We use ferrets. Ferrets is the preferred model. So if this animal on the left was mechanically infected, I would just blow some virus up its nose. You have an airflow going from left to right. Question, that lovely white ferret, will he get infected? And that's an experiment that's been done, and it can occur. So the thing is, in all those pandemic strains, those three pandemic strains, if I infect this animal, this will get infected. So if I have ferret-to-ferret transmission, we read it as Simon-to-Mark transmission, human-to-human transmission. Sorry, Mark, I'm picking on you all the time. Human-to-human.
It's hypothetical.
I'm seronegative. And so this is the question. So it's the deliberate intention to make an infectious virus for humans, and which does not exist. It's an avian virus. Spillover infections, yes, they exist. You've seen them here. You know about spillover infections, rabies. 55,000 cases of infection and 55,000 deaths a year. But if I was infected, I would not infect Mark. That's the way it is. So this is not unknown in science, in biology, in virology. So this is what they're doing. Now, there are two, if I may call it, quantum leaps that have occurred this year, 2012. One is from Dr. Peres's lab, and he's engineered an ostrich H7N1 virus, and that is transmissible between ferrets. It kills 60% of the ferrets. Might I remind you that Spanish flu only killed 2% of humans. This is not small play. This is big numbers. The curious thing about this, and which really bugs me from a virologist, there has been not one recorded infection of H7 in humans. So why do the experiment? Where's the benefit for man? Okay, it can be done. But now, where's the benefit? Oh, yes, it's knowledge. But there's risk, as Mark will tell you in a few minutes. The second experiment by Dr. Kawaroka, he took 8 viruses from birds and then put them together and got a virus that worked, but it didn't infect through the aerosol route. Then he engineered it so it would be infect ferrets through the aerosol route. There's no precedent for it. The probability that such an event, the assembly of 8 fragments from 8 viruses, is very, very small. And the rationale for it, you can say, yes, it's done. I want to climb Everest because it's there. Okay. But why? There's no clear scientific justification, except that now we have a new virus on a planet that could infect you, sir, as opposed to Mark. I've taken a lot of Mark's time. Here we are. Now, the benefits of this work, it was said that by doing this, we would be able to be proactive, and we should try, if possible, and be proactive. Anticipate the next strain of pandemic flu. If we could do that, we could then develop vaccines and drugs. The next line, we've all in real time witnessed the pandemic of 2009. Where did it occur? Northwest Mexico, from a swine, a pig virus. All the bets from the influenza community were Southeast Asia from birds. So our predictive power is not terribly good. The other two, H7N9 and H10N8, I'll pass, but those are examples where they were totally off the radar of the flu community. And there are about 10 papers out there now saying that it is not possible to predict the next pandemic. So that major claim went out. They said that these viruses would be useful for making virus vaccines and drugs. I'm a virologist. I've never made a vaccine. But there is four people on this slide who have made vaccines. There's Pasteur. There's Max Tyler, who made the yellow fever virus. There's Albert Sabin, who made the polio. And there's Stanley Plotkin, who made the rubella. When you inoculate your children with the MMR virus, it's the R. Measles, mumps, rubella. He made that. Of all those gentlemen, Stanley is the only one who's still alive in this world, so I can ask him, what do you think? And he thinks this is just folly. He said there's nothing in this for vaccines. The former president of Merck Vaccine says there's nothing to be had in this work. So Simon's a bench virologist, but there are two well-known gentlemen from the vaccine community who thinks it's folly. I'll say it's unfalsifiable because this is work done in ferrets, and we cannot infect a human being to know. So we can never have 100% proof. We can have conjecture. I think that. But we as scientists, we try to get as hard proof as possible. So I think this gain-of-function work fails and doesn't deliver on its promises, hence nothing good to be gained. Now, actually, you know about gain-of-function. Gain-of-function is Dirk. It's nothing else. Gain-of-function was actually a cover-up to try and make something positive out of this. Gain-of-function is more positive. It sounds good. Dirk, well, you have the ear for Dirk. That's all it is. It's dual-use research of concern, but it sounds positive. I'm sorry, but that's the way it is. Mark will go into the details of risk. I will point out a larger aspect of risk. If ever there was a mistake, well, just take a mild flu. Don't think of a really serious pandemic like Spanish flu or one with 60% mortality. Just take a mild flu season. The economic impact just in the US alone is huge. You are diplomats. You know the diplomatic fallout of this. If a virus escaped from Holland and then infected Russia or infected Germany, you wouldn't accept an explanation, sorry. That's a little weak. The legal responsibilities, because these are now man-made viruses. They're not natural. So it's very easy through modern methods to PCR and find out that this is a genetically coded, barcoded virus, and this is the lab where it comes from. The lawyers will go straight after, and you can see on that slide, this is the size of the endowment of Harvard or Wisconsin. These numbers would pale in insignificance with the sorts of class action suits that would follow. And this is undermining hugely public trust in science, which is something that we cannot afford. There are some other problems in this. It's a large undermention to science. For some reason, no one flagged this up early enough. The learned bodies were strictly inaudible. I do not know why. The Dutch have moved. They've come out with a report. The Germans have moved with the Deutsche Ethikrat report, which is a very good document I can advise reading. And the USA, as Philippa mentioned, has announced this period of discussion and deliberation. So there is movement, but the learned academic societies have been silent. No one has commissioned a risk analysis in 3 years. We're all talking about risk. No government, no funder, no philanthropic association, foundation has financed a risk analysis. Why? No one's considered or consulted lawyers or liability experts. And no one informed the public that they were now exposed to a new risk. We're all waiting for the next flu, seasonal flu to come. But if we made man-made viruses that are now in freezers, you are potentially at risk. No one told you about this. No one said, well, do you mind? I hope they would not ask you that question. But they didn't inform you that the world has slightly changed. And funders simply funded this as though it was more virology. They didn't have their eye or their ears well honed to saying, Houston, we've got a problem, if you remember the Apollo 13 illusion. This is opinions I always like to show. These are two comments from Chinese scientists, one in an article in Science in 2013, one in an interview that was published in the German newspaper Handelsblatt in August 8, 2013. They clearly have, these two individuals have no taste for gain of function. So please don't think it's just a matter of Mark or myself. I would close, if I may. I think gain of function, flu aerosol transmission work. I don't want to get caught on blanket coverage. We scientists, as you know, we like to go on case by case. I think the influenza work represents a hiatus in 130 years of microbiology. We're now making viruses that are dangerous for you, sir, and madam. The work cannot deliver anything that's robust or useful to a health minister, and I think it poses new ethical problems. My own opinion is we need national and standing committees to help people understand what this work is and to give advice. And I think really that modern virology is so powerful that we need input from you, because you've been in biological weapons for years. The virologists, the influenza people, are learning it. And so you have a lot to help to give us, and we would love to hear from you. And finally, if I can have a play on words, the fog is lifting on gain-of-function research. The sunshine is coming in. There's a meeting in Hanover organized by the Volkswagen Stiftung in December, 10 to the 12th, and back-to-back there's this big meeting at the National Academy of Sciences in Washington, D.C. If you would like to contact me, but you don't have time, you have to run off, there's my email, or there's a small blog where you can get some information, and I'll be very happy to either talk now or dialogue through email. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Simon, for that wonderful presentation. It's a lot to take in, and I'm sure you all have burning questions, but I'm going to ask you to hold them until the end, and I'd like to move straight on to Mark's presentation at this point. The floor is yours, Mark. Thank you.
Thank you, and thanks to all of you who are attending. Simon spoke about the benefits or the questionable benefits of this sort of research. And I want to take you through some discussion of the risks. The idea that the risks can be quantified is itself a controversial idea. As we heard with the report on confidence-building measures, some people think they're effective, and others think their verification is not effective. And perhaps I'm making a bit of a forced comparison, but I think in the scientific world there is a division of opinion about whether science can be analyzed in terms of risk or indeed in terms of benefits. I think Simon has told you, proven by example, that the benefits can be analyzed in a rational fashion. And I'm going to try to prove also by example that the risks can be analyzed using the same case study of gain-of-function experiments in flu to enhance transmissibility. I want to start by making a distinction that I think is linguistically dependent. I think in some languages these two words are the same word, but in English we distinguish between biosafety, referring to accident risk, and biosecurity, referring to the risk of malevolent use. And really the initial context in which concern was raised about these kinds of experiments was the biosecurity context. And the real concern was that if the data from the first few experiments on gain of function, creating what I call, using a term of Lynn Klotz's, creating potential pandemic pathogens, people were concerned about the possibility that that would enable malevolent use of this information to create terroristic or weaponized strains of flu. Since that time, and since the publication occurred, I think concern has shifted to a large degree towards the area of biosafety. And clearly these are connected. For example, access control is an aspect of biosafety and also of biosecurity. But there are distinct concerns, and I think the magnitude of risk may be very different from malevolent use and from accident use, and that will vary by pathogens. I'll come back at the end to a question for you. That's been something that's been bothering me, and I think maybe you can help to inform my thinking and the thinking of your colleagues on how these estimates of biosecurity risk should be thought about. But I want to now focus for a few minutes on the issue of creating potentially pandemic or transmissible strains of influenza by gain-of-function experiments on strains of flu that begin as highly pathogenic or highly deadly to humans, but not transmissible among humans. And so when you engineer into a strain that's already highly virulent the ability to transmit in humans, or at least in ferrets, which we believe to be a model for humans, you create a strain that is highly virulent, has pandemic potential, and does not exist in nature. That is, the creation of it measurably adds to the total risk of pathogens that are out there. It's not like taking Ebola virus or some other horrible virus into the laboratory and handling it more safely than it would be handled outside. Rather, it's creating something new that only exists in the laboratory and thereby creates an accident risk. This work is by and large done at biosafety level 3 plus, or enhanced biosafety level 3, which is a level below that used, for example, for work on Ebola virus, Marburg virus, other hemorrhagic fever filoviruses. And what's remarkable is that in some ways those viruses are less worrisome. Those viruses are unquestionably highly virulent to humans. And until several months ago, we would have said have no pandemic potential because they transmit relatively inefficiently among humans. Obviously, the recent events in West Africa have led us to rethink that to some extent, but it remains true that in countries with small numbers of cases and effective infection control, that those viruses can be readily controlled, and indeed accidents in laboratories in developed countries have been controlled without further transmission. Moreover, these viruses exist in nature, and so their existence in a laboratory is not in itself measurably adding to global risk. Nonetheless, we treat those at a higher level of biocontainment, biosafety level 4. Smallpox receives even more conservative treatment. It's, by international agreement, allowed to be used only in two laboratories around the world. Like the strains of enhanced flu that we've been talking about, these combine high virulence with high pandemic potential and no longer exist in nature. That's why they are subject to such high containment and indeed restriction on what sorts of work can be done on them. So they're really the closest parallel to the manufactured flu strains, except in the level of biosecurity and biosafety to which they're subjected. And I should mention that I think Simon and I and all of us who are concerned about PPP creation are nonetheless highly supportive of work to characterize natural strains of H5 and H7 and other highly virulent flu. We are not advocating a reduction. Indeed, we'd probably all favor an increase in work on those natural strains. It's the creation of novel strains that worries us. So I said I would like to prove by example the possibility of doing careful analysis of the risk. And the example that I'm going to give to you is focused on highly virulent, highly readily transmissible flu. It is not the definitive last word. That some further word will come from the risk assessment being commissioned by the U.S. government and hopefully from other analyses. It's simply an effort to suggest to you that this is not an imponderable sort of question for the ages. This is a matter of numbers that are publicly available. And you might choose different numbers, but the numbers are out there, and this should be done. Laboratory accidents have occurred in the recent past leading to onward transmission. The foot and mouth outbreak in the UK in 2007 is perhaps the most well-known recent example, leading to a large outbreak that impacted British agriculture for quite a long period. Perhaps less well-known is the small outbreak of SARS transmission in Beijing. It was a laboratory-acquired, two laboratory-acquired infections in a biosafety level 3 laboratory, leading to 7 secondary infections before the spread was contained. The 1977 influenza reintroduction of H1N1 flu, a strain which then circulated for 22 years globally, infecting millions of people each in most years, is thought to have originated from a laboratory accident. That was an era of lower containment, but that was nonetheless a time when people thought they had adequate containment. The assurances of the people working on it were heard, and this virus escaped and infected millions of people a year for 22 years until the 2009 pandemic. Other examples of accidental infections have occurred in the highest containment level laboratories, SARS in Taiwan, Ebola in Russia, and others that you see on this slide. There were at least 13 laboratory-acquired infections in biosafety level 3 laboratories in the U.S. between 2002 and 2008. I'm happy to share the citations for all of this information. Much of the attention in the United States that led to the funding pause you heard about occurred because there were some high-profile incidents at government laboratories that are assumed to be the best regulated and best run laboratories available. But this is not a new problem. And in fact, the CDC itself, in a paper by Henkel and colleagues, has documented that there's roughly a 0.2% per year risk of a laboratory-associated infection in a biosafety level 3 laboratory. Another set of data compiled by the U.S. government suggests that for each full-time worker that works a full 2,000 hours in a laboratory, there's approximately a 1% chance of infection acquired accidentally in that laboratory. We accept these sorts of risks as a routine possibility because we need to do research on dangerous pathogens. The issues that Simon and I and others are raising are not to suggest that we should aim for zero risk. We should aim for zero risk, but we will never attain it. The concern is that a laboratory infection with almost any of the pathogens we work with on a daily basis is a threat to one or two or a few people because those agents are not readily transmissible in humans. It's the novel creation of agents that have transmission potential in humans and high virulence that takes that relatively low probability per year of an accident and makes it much more threatening. So risk, indeed, is probability times consequence. And so when we try to assess the risk of these kinds of issues, we have to multiply the probability of a pandemic occurring from one unit, say a year, as I just described, of influenza transmissibility gain-of-function research, times the consequence. And I want to walk through an example calculation. Again, these numbers you may wish to disagree with. Others, the advocates of this sort of work, will certainly wish to disagree with. But we need numbers, and we have numbers. The only question is which numbers to use. So on the probability side, the probability that a pandemic occurs from one unit of gain-of-function research is the product of two probabilities, really. It's the probability that a laboratory-acquired infection occurs, which we've just seen can be estimated, times the probability that that leads to a pandemic. I just showed you data suggesting that the estimate for probability is 0.2% per year of biosafety level 3 work. And mathematical models of the sort that many of my colleagues and I work on have estimated that for a flu-like virus, the probability that a single infection leads to widespread transmission is on the order of 5% to 60%, because sometimes infections just fizzle out without going further, but not always. And so we have to account for that probability in estimating the risk of a pandemic. So when you multiply those, you get something on the order of a 1 in 10,000 to 1 in 1,000 chance per biosafety level 3 lab year of a pandemic from gain-of-function research. Now, I mentioned adjusting and debating those numbers, and they are numbers that should be discussed and adjusted upwards and downwards. Some reasons to be reassured compared to those numbers are that there are control measures that could be introduced to try to reduce the spread. The figure of 5 to 20% from the Merler and colleagues study that I cited on the previous slide takes that into account. So, in fact, that is not an appropriate adjustment to his numbers, but there may be some control measures that are not considered that we should consider. We can vaccinate and provide antiviral drugs to laboratory workers. That would reduce the risk that an accident would infect them. It's well known that influenza vaccines and antiviral drugs are imperfect, but that will reduce the risk. Most, if not all, of this work is done in enhanced or BSL-3 plus rather than BSL-3. That essentially exists almost only for the kinds of experiments I've described. So there's no real safety data on the experiments because they're too new. So it may be that we should adjust our risk estimates downward somewhat because we were basing them on biosafety level 3. There are also novel technologies called molecular biocontainment that might reduce the risk if they are used. Reasons to adjust our estimates upwards include undercounting of infections and overcounting of laboratory years. So reporting is very complex. Public reporting is not broken down in such a way that the best estimate can be obtained. So, in fact, the numbers that I gave you are best-case estimates. In other words, the truth is worse than when is higher probabilities than those that I showed you. And there is international variation in laboratory standards, whatever else you may say about the U.S., the laboratory standards of safety are probably among the higher globally. And there has been documentation of global variation, not only in the standards, but in the enforcement of those standards. On the consequence end, we can estimate the consequence as the attack rate or fraction of the population infected in a pandemic times the probability that such an infection leads to mortality or the case fatality risk times the global population. Historically, pandemics have infected between a quarter and two-fifths of the world's population. That's happened every time since we've been counting. The case fatality risk of H5N1 flu, as we know it in humans when they get it from birds, is up to 60%. We could consider the possibility that it would reduce somewhat, and the number of an escape strain might be lower. And so arbitrarily, we can pick 1% as another number. And the global population, I think we can all agree, is somewhere on the order of 7 billion. So when you multiply that for the consequences of a really horrific pandemic, so we're not talking about a pandemic like the 2009 pandemic, which was of a relatively mild virus, but of an engineered, highly virulent, transmissible virus, we're talking on the order of 2 million to 1.4 billion fatalities. Those could also be adjusted. We could imagine the virulence of the strain evolving even below 1%. But on the other hand, as Simon alluded to, mortality is only one of the major costs. There would be major losses of health through non-fatal outcomes. There would be financial and liability losses. There would be loss of the credibility of not just some science, not just biological science, but all the other sciences that are in jeopardy and face credibility problems at the moment, including those such as climate science that really affect our global future. There would be school closures, et cetera. So there are a lot of costs that are not taken up by simple mortality. But when you multiply these numbers together, you get a really remarkable outcome. When you multiply a risk of 1 in 10,000 to 1 in 1,000 by the number of fatalities, what you conclude is that a single year of work is expected in the sort of actuarial terms of multiplying probability times consequence to kill somewhere between 2,000 and 1.4 million people. We would not countenance a laboratory, funding a research grant that was expected to kill two people, or 0.2 people, or 0.02 people probably. But these numbers are obscenely high. And if you'd like to debate them, we might decide to go a little bit down. Maybe we'd go down by an order of magnitude or two. But we're still in such a high range that that ordinary ethical considerations would say we don't do it. This has been raised by some as an issue of scientific freedom. And different countries have different views on whether scientific freedom of inquiry is a fundamental human right or a privilege or something in between. But it should be said that most science, even in those places that consider scientific freedom a fundamental human right, most science that could produce interesting results is not done, and some is prohibited. For example, most importantly, most good ideas there's no money for. Grants are not funded. In the United States right now, infectious disease research is funded at about 10% of all the proposals that come in. To the extent that that's a rational decision, it's because the benefits are too small, and you just heard about the benefits of this sort of work, or because the approach is not the best way to get the knowledge, there's some other way to do it, or because there's just not enough money. We also prohibit work for reasons of human subjects' welfare, animal welfare, or biosafety. For example, smallpox experiments are overseen, as you know, by an international committee, and some experiments are prohibited. So this is not an issue of scientific freedom. Scientific freedom is the freedom to try to do certain things, but it is but when we decide which things to do, we always take into account the costs and the benefits, and in this unusual case where the risks are enormous, we should be taking into account the risks. So how should we think about this question? Some have suggested that we should frame it as a question of whether we should do these experiments or not. And this is a cartoon from Le Monde, which had a long article on this kind of work. That's the wrong way to frame the choice. It is very unusual and indeed unscientific to say, should we do an experiment or not do the experiment and not discuss what to do instead. What we actually do is we talk about what are the goals of doing science and what are the means to achieve those goals. And the goals of doing science on influenza are to learn about influenza and also to defeat influenza, to reduce morbidity and mortality globally. And there are many ways to study influenza and even more ways to defeat it. Engineering potential pandemic pathogens is one, which almost uniquely carries a high risk to life and also carries a high cost because of the ferrets required and the containment levels. There are studies that could be performed in vitro using defective viruses that have essentially no risk of infection, are much higher throughput because they can be done at much lower cost and are therefore more generalizable. We can study natural isolates of bird strains and human strains and try to understand what makes them different from one another. And then moving more broadly into the issue of trying to defeat flu, as all of us know, you don't have to understand something in order to destroy it. It helps, but it's not necessary. So we can work on developing vaccines that are universal. And indeed, universal flu vaccines are a major area of research that could benefit from additional investment. We can work to accelerate vaccine production, making it faster, cheaper, and more readily available to more people in a rapid time frame. We can develop other alternative therapeutics that don't require understanding the virus so much as understanding the host response. And paper in PLOS Medicine by myself and Alison Galvani earlier this year gives a much more complete list with citations of all of these. So when we weigh these risks and benefits, it's again up for discussion how we do that. I would argue that the way to do it is to consider portfolios of research. That's what national funders do, that's what philanthropists do, that's what any sensible consideration of of science policy does. It doesn't say, should we do this or not? It says, what should our portfolio be? And on the one hand, there could be a portfolio of potential pandemic pathogen creation, alternative approaches to flu virology like the ones I just described, and alternative approaches that are not flu virology but are ways of trying to defeat the flu, like some of the ones I just described. Weighing against that, we can consider the benefits of an expanded portfolio of those alternatives, using the resources freed up by potential pandemic pathogen experiments not done, and those are very expensive, as I'll remind you again, compared to many of the other approaches. And we should ask which of those portfolios is more likely to help us to defeat the flu, knowing that we pay an opportunity cost by doing any given experiment in those experiments that we then don't do because we can't afford everything. And we should weigh them and decide, is there some, which one has greater benefits? We also have to consider the risks of the sort that I just described. And if the numbers that I just described to you are anywhere close to reality, they don't have to be right. They have to be within three or four or five orders of magnitude of right. Then they are enormous compared to those involved in any other scientific experiment that I can think of. And we should weigh those as favoring the alternatives. We can weigh the risks of alternative measures as favoring on the other side, but the risks of the alternatives are essentially negligible because they don't involve creating novel pathogens. So in my view, as you will have guessed, this is a very clear balance, and it really favors a robust portfolio of alternative work that does not involve the creation of potential pandemic pathogens. Ethical considerations also must enter into this, and the bioethicists have also been somewhat quiet and somewhat not consulted on this topic. One of the founding documents of bioethics and modern research ethics in particular is the Nuremberg Code, which does not apply at the moment to these sorts of experiments because it applies only to experiments that are directly on human subjects. But listen to the principles that are stated in that code and think about what they might mean in the context of experiments that affect potentially the entire globe. So if you put an individual human subject at some risk, not necessarily a risk of life, but some risk, the experiment, according to the Nuremberg Code, should be such as to yield fruitful results for the good of society unprocurable by other means or methods of study and not random or unnecessary. So in the Nuremberg Code, there's the idea of alternatives is already there. And the issue of weighing risk against benefit is also there. The degree of risk taken should never exceed that determined by the humanitarian importance of the problem to be solved by the experiment. Nothing in that really needs to be about human subjects. It just happens to have been developed in the context of experiments that were directly on humans. But if you're putting human life at risk, it would seem that such ethical principles might apply. I want to bring this back to the biological weapons area and really ask for your input at this stage, because as I mentioned, the biological weapons aspect of this was what came up before the safety aspects. And I think part of the reason why it has declined in as an issue is a sense among many people that these engineered potentially pandemic strains of flu would not be good bioweapons. And the ideas, as I've gleaned them from essentially from conversation, is that a rational actor using a bioweapon would want to be able to control its spread, protect themselves and their friendlies, and be able to contain and hide accidents. Of course, a non-rational actor might have a very different set of priorities. So I think that part of the reason this has gone off the biological weapons agenda to a certain degree, and I ask your thoughts about whether this is sensible, is the sense that it's not making good biological weapons. So what I would ask you is, from the fact that several of the most dangerous pathogens, not just these, would be allegedly poured bioweapons because they're too contagious, there are no countermeasures, no way to protect yourself, does it follow that biosecurity concern about these agents should be lower? And, for example, that publication of the details of these experiments should be of less concern. And I honestly do not know what I think about this, so I'm asking this as a true question. The reason I find this both somewhat compelling and somewhat concerning as a way of thinking is the example of the Aum Shinrikyo anthrax attacks. Now, I think it's agreed by most that Aum Shinrikyo was not a rational actor and had non-rational goals, to the extent we could even call them goals. But they were also incompetent. They were not simply trying to do something crazy. They were also bad at it. They chose an anthrax strain that happened to be a vaccine strain rather than a virulent strain. So the question is, are rational actors also always competent? And should we expect that those who might choose to use dual-use information for ill will do it in the way that we would consider most self-interestedly intelligent? Or should we be concerned that someone might rationally, but because of poor information, choose a bad bioweapon such as these? And I will leave it on that questioning note.
Thank you very much, Mark. Thank you all for listening and for your contributions. And if you would like to join me all in thanking our panelists here today, thank you, everybody.